Have you ever looked at a successful business, maybe? A company whose stock you own or a brand you really admire, and wondered what's really going on under the hood? You know, beyond the shiny products and the clever marketing, there's this powerful story told in numbers. It's like a financial heartbeat that reveals its true health.
That's a great way to put it.
So today, we're taking a deep dive into something called final accounts.
Uh-huh.
Now, that might sound, well, a bit dry, maybe something only an accountant could love.
Hey, it can seem that way at first glance.
But trust me, understanding these is like gaining x-ray vision into any organization. It's kind of the ultimate shortcut to being truly well-informed. It gives you the power to see the financial pulse of, well, everything from huge tech giants to your local coffee shop.
Absolutely.
Let's unpack these essential financial statements then and uncover why they're just so much more than numbers on a page.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is that these aren't just, you know, complicated documents for financial wizards. Final accounts are actually a fundamental legal requirement for most businesses globally. Ah, okay, a legal thing.
Yes, but maybe more importantly, they are a really powerful communication tool. They offer this transparent window into a business's financial performance, its position, to a whole ecosystem of people.
Right.
And each of these people, these stakeholders, they have their own unique interests and questions.
That makes a lot of sense. So who exactly are these diverse groups of people, and what specific insights are they trying to, you know, pull out from these reports?
Well, let's think about a few. For shareholders or owners, it's pretty straightforward. It's all about profitability, isn't it? And return on investment.
Are they making money?
Exactly. Are they making money? Can they expect dividends? Are there opportunities to reinvest and grow their wealth? That's their focus.
Okay.
Then you have managers inside the company. For them, these accounts are like their internal GPS.
Huh. I like that.
Yeah. They guide them to evaluate performance, maybe pinpoint cost inefficiencies, and really chart the company's future strategy. It's like their internal report card, but also their operational playbook. And what about, say, those of us who just work for a business? Or maybe even thinking about joining one. Do these matter to us?
Oh, absolutely. For employees, these accounts can signal things like job security, potential for wage growth, and just the overall stability of their working conditions. You know, a financially healthy company offers a certain peace of mind.
Definitely.
Lenders and creditors, on the other hand, they're strictly focused on risk and repayment. They're looking at the business's capacity to service its debts.
Can they pay us back?
Can they trust this business to pay them back on time? That's the crucial question. It's a key measure of financial trustworthiness.
Okay, I can totally see how the government would be interested, you know, for tax reasons.
Yep, taxes and compliance.
But are there other, maybe less obvious stakeholders involved?
You're right about the government ensuring accurate tax payments, compliance with regulations, general oversight. But think about suppliers. They often extend credit, right? They provide goods and services before they get paid. So they really need some assurance that the business is financially strong enough to actually pay its invoices.
Makes sense.
And even the broader public and community. They often look at these accounts to gauge things like corporate accountability. Is the company behaving responsibly? And what about its long-term sustainability?
Wow.
So ultimately, these accounts build and maintain trust across the entire economic ecosystem. It's quite fundamental.
It's incredible how many different lenses are applied to the, well, the same set of documents.
Mm.
So if we're going to get this x-ray vision, what are the main financial statements we need to get a handle on?
Right. To gain that insight, we mostly focus on two core final accounts. First, there's the profit and loss account. You'll often hear it called the income statement.
Okay. P&L?
Exactly, the P&L.
Yeah.
This report tells the story of a business's profitability over a period of time, could be a quarter, could be a full financial year. It's sort of the action movie of a company's operations.
The action movie, I like it. Okay, what's the other one?
The second is the balance sheet, which is also known as the statement of financial position. Now, this one provides a snapshot, like a photograph.
Okay.
It shows the financial health of the business at a single precise moment in time. Typically, that's the last day of the financial year.
So, on the surface, they look like pretty distinct reports, right? A period of time versus a single moment. But where's the hidden connection? How do these two sort of separate lenses combine to give us one complete picture?
Ah, that's the really clever part. They're intrinsically linked. They're not separate things entirely.
How so?
Well, the profit or loss that's generated and shown in the profit and loss account, it doesn't just vanish into thin air. It directly impacts what we call retained earnings,
Retained earnings.
which are basically the profits a company decides to hold on to rather than pay out. And those retained earnings, they're a key component of the company's balance sheet.
Ah, I see. So the P&L feeds the balance sheet.
Precisely. The story of how a company performed over the year directly shapes its financial standing at the end of that year. One feeds directly into the other. It gives you this continuous, evolving narrative.
Got it. Okay, let's zoom in on that action movie first, then the profit and loss account. What kind of story does it truly tell about a business's day-to-day operations and, how it actually makes its money?
Right. The P&L isn't just a list of sales numbers. It's really the financial narrative of a company's, let's say, daily fight for survival and growth.
Yeah.
It meticulously records all the revenues earned, every single cost, every expense incurred over that period, and ultimately it reveals whether the company actually made a profit or perhaps a loss. It tells you if their core business model is generating cash or if they're just, busy spinning their wheels.
Okay, can you walk us through its typical structure? What are the key sort of milestones in that financial narrative?
Absolutely. It generally flows something like this. You start right at the top with revenue, sometimes called sales. That's the total money earned from selling goods or services, the big number everyone talks about.
At top line.
The top line, exactly. Then you immediately subtract the cost of sales. Now, these are the direct costs of producing whatever was sold. Think raw materials, direct factory labor.
Stuff that went into the product.
Precisely. And what you're left with after that subtraction is gross profit. This shows the profit generated just from making and selling the product itself before you consider any overheads or general running costs.
Okay, so that's the profit just from the core product or service. What comes next?
After gross profit, you then account for all the other expenses. These are the indirect costs of running the entire business.
Like rent, salaries.
Exactly. Rent for the office, salaries for admin staff, utility bills, marketing campaigns, you name it. Subtracting all of those from your gross profit gives you profit before tax.
Almost there.
Almost there. And finally, after you account for all costs and taxes have been deducted, what remains is the net profit, sometimes called profit for the year. That's the famous bottom line. It was
Yeah.
the ultimate measure of how financially successful that period actually was for the company.
So for businesses that are always looking to boost that bottom line, what are the key levers they can pull based on this P&L structure to improve profitability? I mean, this must be a constant question for any manager.
Oh, absolutely. It's a critical question. And the P&L actually lays out a very clear roadmap for improving financial performance. Managers can primarily focus on three areas.
Okay.
First, obviously, increasing sales revenue,
Yeah.
getting more money in the door.
Higher prices, more customers.
Both, potentially, raising prices strategically, expanding marketing efforts to reach new customers, or simply selling a higher volume of goods or services. That's lever one. Second, they can work hard to reduce the cost of sales. This involves things like smart procurement, maybe negotiating better deals with suppliers, or using bulk purchase discounts to cut the direct cost of what they sell, making things cheaper.
Okay, make it cheaper or sell more. What's the third?
The third is to reduce expenses, those overheads we talked about. This might mean finding more affordable office space, investing in energy-efficient technology to cut utility bills, or rigorously scrutinizing and cutting any unnecessary operational costs, like maybe certain advertising spends.
So the P&L tells us about that profitability dance over time. But to really understand a company's financial stance, its stability and what it actually owns, right now we need that balance sheet.
Exactly.
If the P&L is the movie, the balance sheet is the snapshot. How does this snapshot complete our X-ray vision?
Well, the balance sheet is built on this fundamental, almost elegant equation. Assets, liabilities plus equity.
Assets equals liabilities plus equity.
Yeah.
It's a precise statement that shows exactly what a business owns, its assets, what it owes to others, its liabilities, and what ultimately belongs to the owners, the equity, on one very specific date. Think of it like a carefully composed photograph of the company's financial state on, say, December 31st, just a single moment frozen in time.
Can you break down those three components for us, maybe with some concrete examples so we can really grasp what's being accounted for?
Certainly. Let's start with assets. These are basically everything the company controls that's expected to bring in future economic benefits, stuff that's valuable.
Okay.
And we usually categorize them. Non-current assets are the long-term things, the workhorses, intended for use over many years. Think land, buildings, heavy machinery, even intellectual property like patents can be here.
Right, the big ticket, long-lasting items.
Exactly. Then you have current assets. These are short-term. They can usually be converted to cash within about 12 months. This includes cash itself, obviously, inventory or stock waiting to be sold, and also money owed to the business by its customers. We call those debtors or accounts receivable.
Okay, so that's everything the business has that's valuable, long-term and short-term.
Yeah.
What about what it owes?
That brings us neatly to liabilities. These are the financial obligations or debts of the business, what it owes to others.
Okay.
And again, typically two categories. Current liabilities are debts that are due pretty soon, usually within 12 months. Things like money owed to suppliers, we call them creditors, or accounts payable, or maybe short-term bank overdrafts.
Bills come and due.
Basically, yes. Then you have non-current liabilities. These are the longer-term debts due after 12 months. Think substantial bank loans, mortgages on property.
Right. The big long-term borrowings.
Exactly. And finally, that third piece, equity. This represents the owner's residual claim on the assets after all the liabilities have been paid off. It's what's left over for the owners. It includes their initial investment, often called share capital, and those retained earnings we mentioned earlier, the accumulated profits the company has kept over time.
So why is this snapshot, this balance sheet, so crucial? I mean, beyond just knowing what a company owns and owes, who uses it, and for what specific purpose?
Well, the balance sheet serves several really vital purposes that go way beyond simple accounting. It explicitly shows how the company's assets are financed. Is it mostly through borrowing the liabilities or through the owner's money, the equity?
Okay, the funding mix.
Exactly. And it's absolutely critical for assessing a business's solvency, that's its ability to meet its long-term debts. Can it survive in the long run? And also its liquidity, its ability to meet its short-term debts. Can it pay its bills next month?
Solvency and liquidity, key terms.
Very key. This ensures overall financial stability. Auditors, as you'd expect, rigorously examine it. Lenders use it constantly to make credit decisions. And investors, they pore over it to gauge a company's financial health and its capital structure before they commit their money. It's really the ultimate stability check.
Okay, we've covered physical assets like buildings, machinery. But what about the things you can't touch or see, but that are incredibly valuable to a business, especially in today's economy?
Yes. That brings us to the fascinating world of intangible assets. These are non-physical assets. Despite being invisible, they can provide significant long-term value and a real competitive advantage to a business.
Intangible. So invisible value.
Pretty much. They're often overlooked by casual observers, maybe because they're not on the factory floor, but they can be absolutely critical to a company's true worth.
What makes these intangible assets so tricky to sort of nail down? And why are we sometimes surprised by their actual worth?
Well, you can't physically touch or see them, right? Yet they hold substantial monetary and legal value. The trickiness really comes in accurately valuing them because they aren't physical things you can easily appraise. How do you put a precise dollar value on a company's reputation, for example? This makes them a really interesting area for investors because their true value might be underestimated by the market. Yet they provide this powerful competitive advantage that can set a business far apart from its rivals.
Okay, give us some specific examples that might highlight their hidden power. What are we talking about here?
Okay, think about patents. These are legal rights protecting inventions. They're the absolute foundation of many tech and pharmaceutical companies.
Right.
Then there are trademarks, those distinctive logos, branding symbols, sounds even, that make a product instantly recognizable, like, you know, a certain swoosh or maybe a bitten apple.
Yeah.
Goodwill is another really interesting one. It represents the value of a company's reputation, its established customer loyalty, its existing business relationships. It can be enormous, especially when one company buys another.
So it's like the premium you pay for an established business.
In essence, yes. We also have copyrights, giving legal protection for creative works, music, books, software code, and just pure brand recognition. The kind of market identity that allows a company to command higher prices simply because people know and trust the brand.
Wow.
These are especially vital, as you can imagine, in industries driven by intellectual property, think technology, entertainment, pharmaceuticals. Their value can dwarf the physical assets sometimes.
Okay, another thing. We all know, say, our cars lose value the moment we drive them off the lot.
Mm.
How do businesses account for their big assets? Machinery, vehicles, even buildings losing value over time. They don't stay new forever.
No, they certainly don't. And this is where depreciation comes into the picture. Non-current assets, with the notable exception of land, which often appreciates.
Right, land is different.
Land is usually different, but most other non-current assets naturally lose value over time. And it's usually due to two main factors. First, simple wear and tear, the physical damage from being used repeatedly. Second, obsolescence. This is where an asset becomes outdated or less useful because of technological advancements or maybe shifts in market demand, even if it's still physically working fine. Think of an old computer.
Still works, but nobody wants it.
Exactly. So depreciation ensures that the cost of that asset is spread fairly over its expected useful lifespan. It prevents the business from overstating its value on the balance sheet and gives a much more realistic picture of its financial health over time.
So how do they actually calculate this loss in value? What are the main methods? And I guess, what are the implications of choosing one method over another? Does it matter?
It does matter. There are primarily two common methods used, and the choice isn't just some random accounting decision. It often reflects a company's financial philosophy or the nature of the asset. The first is the straight line method.
Straight line. Sounds simple.
It is pretty simple. Here, you basically take the cost of the asset, subtract its expected residual value. That's what you think you can sell it for at the very end of its useful life.
Like a scrap value.
Could be scrap value or maybe a trade-in value, yes. You take that difference, the depreciable amount, and you just spread it evenly over the number of years you expect to use the asset.
Okay, can you give us a quick example?
Sure. Let's say a machine costs $30,000. You expect it to last 3 years, and at the end, you think you can sell it for $6,000. So the total value loss is $24,000. $30,000 minus $6,000.
Right.
With the straight line method, you just divide that $24,000 by 3 years. That means you record an $8,000 depreciation expense each year for 3 years.
Okay, predictable, consistent.
Exactly. It's simple, predictable, and it's often great for assets like, say, office furniture or maybe some vehicles that tend to wear out fairly consistently over time.
What's the other main method?
The second common method is the units of production method. Now, this one links the depreciation expense directly to how much the asset is actually used.
Ah, so it's based on output, not just time passing.
Precisely. This makes a lot of sense for something like a factory machine, where its value really depends on how many widgets it produces, not just how many years it sits there.
Okay, how does that calculation work then? How does it impact the numbers year to year?
Well, let's use that same $30,000 machine with the $6,000 residual value. But this time, let's say we expect it to produce a total of 60,000 units over its entire life.
Okay.
First, you calculate a depreciation rate per unit. So that's the $24,000 depreciable amount divided by 60,000 units, which comes out to $0.40 per unit.
40 cents per widget.
40 cents depreciation for every widget makes. So if in year one it's really busy and produces 24,000 units, the depreciation expense for that year is 24,000 units times $0.40, which is $9,600.
Higher than the straight line method that year.
Right. But maybe in year two, demand slows down and it only produces 15,000 units. Then the depreciation is 15,000 times 0.40, which is only $6,000.
I see. So it matches the expense to the actual economic benefit or usage.
Exactly. The beauty here is that the expense directly matches the asset's economic contribution in that period. It makes it very accurate, especially for heavily utilized or production-focused machinery.
So the choice of method isn't just arbitrary, is it? It sounds like a strategic decision that can significantly impact a company's reported profitability each year, and maybe even its tax burden. It gives us a glimpse into management's thinking.
That's exactly right. The straight line method offers those consistent, predictable expenses. It's often preferred for assets like office buildings or general vehicles that arguably provide a fairly equal benefit over time. The units of production method, however, is much more suited for assets whose value and lifespan are really directly tied to how much they're used, heavy manufacturing equipment, industrial ovens, things like that. The choice really does communicate something about how a company views its assets' contribution to its bottom line.
Fascinating. Okay, beyond all the numbers, the formulas, the statements, what really underpins the integrity and the reliability of all these financial reports? What's the bedrock? What's the foundation of trust here?
That's such an essential point, and it really boils down to two critical pillars: confidentiality and professional ethics. Think about it. Accountants, managers, executives, they are privy to incredibly sensitive financial information. stuff the public doesn't see, maybe competitors would love to know. It is absolutely paramount that this data is handled with the utmost care, integrity, and crucially, that it's not misused for personal gain.
Right. Things like insider trading come to mind.
Precisely that. Insider trading is exactly that, using confidential, non-public financial details to profit unfairly from stock market trades. It's illegal, obviously, but it's also highly unethical. Maintaining strict confidentiality and adhering to strong professional ethics are absolutely central to ensuring trustworthy accounting practices and reliable financial reporting. The whole system hinges on that trust.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? We've kind of journeyed from understanding why all these different stakeholders care so deeply about financial transparency through the core components, the P&L, the balance sheet.
Mm-hmm.
We've looked at the hidden value of those intangible assets.
Yeah, the invisible value.
And even the nuanced ways businesses account for simple wear and tear through depreciation.
Well, what seems abundantly clear, I hope, is that final accounts are far more than just dry numbers on a page. They are the living, breathing narrative of a business's health, its past performance, and indeed, its future potential. Understanding them really empowers you to look beyond the headlines, beyond the marketing spin, and see the real story.
Yeah, our mission today was really to give you that shortcut to being well-informed, to equip you with that kind of X-ray vision we talked about at the start.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully, with this deep dive, you now have a powerful new lens through which to view any organization's financial story, whether it's one you work for, one you might invest in, or just one you read about in the news.
And this raises, I think, an important question for you to consider. Now that you have this deeper understanding, how will you interpret a company's quarterly earnings report differently next time you see one? Or perhaps how might this knowledge change the way you evaluate a potential investment or maybe even your next career move? What really stands out to you now that you know a bit more about how to read between the lines of these fundamental financial reports?